Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, so glad you could join us for some conversation about classic cardboard, or shall we say a cardboard classic conversation, or conversation about cardboard classics. I don't know. Just work those three C's in there somewhere, and we'll have a conversation about some great cards from the past, or in some cases, not so great cards. And that is kind of the crux of today's program. It's not a great set, but it was a great idea. And I think the best way to describe the set that we are going to be discussing today is not necessarily right idea, wrong time, but just something that had a lot of good things going for it, a really bright idea, and it just fizzled out. And there were a lot of factors as to why the Donruss triple play set just didn't work. And it's been revived once, and the revival didn't work either. But we're going to be focusing on the premier edition of 1992 Donruss triple play. However, to tell the Donruss triple play story of 1992, you have to kind of look at the history of the entire series of cards, which is a short one. It just stretches through 1994 and then that 2013 revival. But there were a lot of things to like about Donruss triple play, enough that we're even talking about it a second time. And it's a set that doesn't have any high dollar cards. Of course, it's right in the heart of the junk wax era, so what would you expect, right? There are some cards that if you track them down and get them graded, yeah, you can get a few extra bucks for them. But it is loaded with star cards. It was a little ahead of the curve with some unique cards, but it was also stuck in a very interesting vacuum, not just in the time when it was released, you know, right in the thick of the junk wax era, which was about to change for the premium sets and then subsets and inserts, but also just in time. You know, some of the things that Donruss tried to do with triple play, had it happened, you know, maybe 5 years earlier, perhaps it would have caught on. Certainly not 5 years later, because some of the special cards that Donruss tried to debut with triple play in 1992 pretty much got squashed by the internet. You know, what was cool and trendy in 1992 by 4 or 5 years later just really wasn't all that cool and trendy. And certain special cards that you got in the triple play set, you could find these particular card topics, whether it be stadiums or action shots or pictures of players when they were kids, you could find those online as Americans were starting to figure out how the internet worked and how you could work it to your advantage and getting educated by it. So, you know, there's a lot to the triple play story. And like I said, it's not necessarily a right idea, wrong time, because as we'll discuss, there really wasn't a great time for it, but it was a pretty good idea that had all the right intentions. It just could not pull everything together, and it had a lot going against it outside of the creation of the card. And really the best comparison is, you know, not from you know, a marketing story like New Coke. You know, New Coke was just a disaster. It was just an ill-advised change to an already good product. And of course, the New Coke story is evidence piece A of, you know, what not to do with a legacy product or a legacy service, or, you know, certainly from the marketing angle, you know, don't introduce something as new and exciting and invigorating when it's really just crap and your fans are going to hate you for it. Now, I think the best comparison actually comes from the automotive industry. If you've ever heard of the Tucker vehicle, known as the Tucker 48, the Tucker Torpedo, there's a movie that was made back in, I want to say, 1988, called Tucker, the Man and His Dream. And it starred Jeff Bridges as Preston Tucker, the creator of the Tucker Torpedo. And the short story of the Tucker Torpedo is Preston Tucker came up with this radical new car that had all sorts of features that were just light years ahead of its time. It had three headlights. The headlights actually turned with the steering wheel to provide better illumination on the highway. The windshields would actually pop out in an accident, which sounds bizarre, but you have to think in the 1940s, you had these solid glass windshields. So, you know, if you went through the windshield in an accident, chances are you were dead. But this at least, you know, you didn't go through the glass. You just kind of went around it in a weird way. But you know, there were all sorts of things that were unique with the Tucker Torpedo. And you know, the story is basically that, you know, Preston Tucker fought the big three automakers, fought Congress. There was an investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission and stock fraud accusations. And, you know, basically the Tucker lasted 1 year. There were only 51 cars made, including the prototype. So the Tucker is an extremely sought after piece of historical, you know, reference that is, you know, it's very, very expensive to find one of these. And of the 51 that were made, there were only, trying to think how many were last accounted for, 36, I want to say 37, something like that. There, you know, there's some of them obviously over time, you know, wasted away and rusted out. But, you know, the reason why I tell you the Tucker story, first of all, if you get to watch the movie Tucker, The Man and His Dreams, it's a good one. Francis Ford Coppola was the director. Like I said, Jeff Bridges did a great job acting as Preston Tucker. But the reason why I bring that up is that if you do a little research on the Tucker 48, it's, like I said, so many pieces of it were just so far ahead. It was just a great idea, and it just ran into so many headwinds and eventually went away. Now, I don't think Donruss Triple Play will quite fall into the legacy status that the Tucker Motor Company did. You know, Tucker had a movie made about it 40 years later. I'm not anticipating a massive public release of the story of Donruss Triple Play coming to theaters near you in the summer of 2032. I don't even know if there'll be movie theaters in 2032, but I'm pretty certain that there won't be a full-length movie about the Donruss Triple Play set. But that's just the best comparison off the top of my head. You know, like I said, not an ill-advised idea and bad PR campaign like New Coke. It was just a pretty good idea that had a lot of potential, but just so many things out of its control that drove it down. And then just some bad decisions by Donruss as well. It had a very short shelf life, even though there were a lot of things to like about Triple Play. It is also, as I've mentioned, one of those sets where I wish I didn't buy as many of those cards in 1992 and perhaps should have spent my money a little more wisely back then instead of loading up on Triple Play cards. So we'll talk about that in this episode. We'll also bring up our bottom of the order, three players that we selected from the randomly selected from the jumbo pack of Donruss Triple Play cards that we opened up recently. It's on our YouTube channel. Look for Wax Ecstatic on YouTube. Subscribe to it, please, if you get the chance. And you can look at the 1992 Donruss Triple Play pack open. We posted that video yesterday. And you can see what's inside, some star cards, some pretty neat cards. That was a hallmark of the Triple Play set. And you can check that out again on the new Wax Ecstatic YouTube channel. And you can take a look at some of the fun colors and photo angles and all the neat things that were on there. And you can see some of the promise, but also certainly some of the problems that were going to come from Donruss Triple Play. Now, where did we get the idea for this particular show? Like I said, it was just one of those shows or one of those sets that we talked about the first time about 4 years ago when we were going through the original Monster Box cards in the show. And we just kind of moved on from it. And this was the final show suggested by listeners that we take a second look at past sets. So recently we've done 87 Donruss, 85 tops as well, and then most recently 89 Donruss. So 92 Donruss triple play, the final of the four shows as suggested by our fans. Now, we've had a lot of fun going back and taking second look at cards, and we did a couple from the junk wax era, a couple from the early to mid 80s, so not junk wax, but as the hobby was heating up. So I think one thing that we'll be doing over the next couple of weeks is putting up another survey, and I think we'll do one set from each decade. We'll do 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the sets that we have only talked about once. And, there are a couple over those years that we've dove into. There we go. I was going to say divin. Oh, goodness, the heat's getting to me. Dove into over two or three times over the course of this show. But there are a couple others that, again, we just kind of talked about, whether we loved it or maybe they didn't love it and we just kind of moved on about it. But we want to take a second look at some of these sets here. So be on the lookout for those. Again, on our Twitter handle, at Wax and Gumstains, we will be handling that in the next couple of weeks just to line up a few show topics. We've got plenty more in the hopper as well. And just a reminder, I will be relocating to Arizona this summer. So we're not going to have a show on Saturday, July 3rd, or Friday, July 2nd, I should say, for a couple of reasons. One, that is actually when my family is moving. We're doing the cross-country move from Florida to Arizona, which is quite a haul. But also, it's the 4th of July weekend, and you probably have some better plans in mind than listening to this program. So I will highly recommend that you check out the archived shows. Listen to some of those older shows from, say, 3, 4, even 5 years ago. You know, we've been doing this since the summer of 2016. And check out some of the older shows. Maybe there's a card set that you've forgotten about over the years. And we've got all of the shows that are up there for free. You can do it at our home base at audioboom.com or whichever platform you listen to the podcast on. Check out those archives for free. So that'll be the suggestion for Friday, July 2nd. Again, no show 2 weeks from now like we would normally do. We should be settled in rather nicely 2 weeks after that. However, that will be Friday, July 16th. That will be our next program. So again, appreciate your patience. I know over the years we've gotten into this nice little rhythm of shows every other week, but it's a little bit of a undertaking taking my wife, my two kids, and two cats across the country in the dead of summer. I am actually in Phoenix, Arizona right now as I record this. It is only 118 degrees. So if it sounds like I'm in a hotel room recording this, well, I am. And I can guarantee you the air conditioner will kick on at some point during this program. So you're going to hear a little noise in the background. But for my comfort and for yours, because you don't want an angry host sitting in 118 degree heat, we'll have the AC kick on. By the way, I've moved up in life, went from the Howard Johnson to the Hampton Inn. So things are certainly looking up from here. Now, one last thing that I want to remind you is that we are continuing to work on the website, waxandgumstands.com. Received a lot of great feedback from our survey. We still have the SurveyMonkey link, or didn't they change their name recently? It's just another one of those companies that changed a rather unique name like SurveyMonkey to something really dumb and forgettable, which is unfortunate. But anyways, we've got the SurveyMonkey link still in our profile on Twitter. So if you go to Wax and Gumstands and click on the profile link, you'll see the SurveyMonkey link there. Click on that and give us your responses to what you would like to see on waxandgumstains.com. And we will be working on that once we get the move done. We'll be working on that over the following few weeks to give you a nice and neat little website here, a complement, not a replacement, a complement to the Wax Ecstatic podcast. And like I said, we've gotten some great responses. Thank you if you've already responded to it. If you haven't yet, you still have a few more weeks to do it, and we certainly would like your input. All right, let's cut to the chase with 1992 Donruss Triple Play. And let's talk about some of the positives of the 1992 Donruss Triple Play set. And it is a fun set. Like I said, I wish I didn't quite spend as much money back in the day on it as I did. But even opening up the jumbo pack that I opened on that video, it was kind of fun to just rip through these old cards and see what made Donruss Triple Play so unique. And the big thing that Donruss was trying to do, it was first of all trying to carve a new revenue stream. It was trying to find younger collectors. And when I say younger, I mean very young. Donruss actually marketed this to children aged 5 through 12. So they were really trying to hook kids into baseball cards at a very young age. Now, at the time, summer of 1992, let's see, I was 14 going on 15, so I was a little older than the target demo. But I thought the set was pretty neat and fun and affordable. That was a big thing. If I recall correctly, the regular wax packs were under a dollar. I want to say maybe 79 cents. And then the jumbo packs were also pretty affordable for 40 cards, which included the Perez Steel, not the Diamond King, that wasn't the name of it, the Perez Steel Gallery of Stars inserts. I want to say those were priced at like $1.99 or something, which compared to a lot of the other sets which were moving on to the premium angle. You know, the new packs were averaging like a dollar a piece. Jumbo packs, if you were getting Upper Decker, Stadium Club, or anything like that, you know, you were going to be paying a lot more money for those cards. So, you know, this was a break for people who were on a limited budget. But again, the target was kids. And the idea was, well, if you're not going to go out and spend $1.49 for a pack of Donruss base set cards, or if you didn't have the extra couple of bucks to splurge on the premium pinnacle set that Donruss had released back then certainly you can, you know, for under a dollar, take these kind of neat cards and enjoy them at your leisure. And Donruss was trying to not only create that new revenue stream, but also trying to rebuff some of the complaints that were coming from longtime collectors and certainly parents who may or may not have collected at some point in time. And it was precisely because kids were getting priced out. And you could see the warning signs of this coming a mile down the road as more and more cards were being created, new sets were created, prices of packs went from 30 to 35 cents a piece. They were, you know, nudging up to 55, 60, 65 cents a piece by 1992. Premium sets well over a dollar. And, you know, kids, of course, including myself. Now, if I was lucky enough, I would raise a lot of money mowing neighbors' yards, and I could get 10, 12, 15, sometimes 20 bucks a yard, depending on the size of the yard and the generosity of the house owner. But, you know, especially in that 5 to 12-year-old range there, most kids, unless they have a generous parent just giving them money like an ATM, you're not going to get 10, 12, 15, 20 bucks for anything. You know, even if you just did your household chores, chances are you were only getting a dollar or two per week, and that's barely enough to even get a single pack of cards. So this was an answer that Donruss had to the critics about, you're no longer making cards for kids. They're too expensive. It's nothing but adults with deep pockets taking over the hobby. What are you going to do about it? So both Donruss and Topps tried to answer that. Donruss with Triple Play, Topps had the Topps for Kids cards around the same time. Another effort with a lot of good ideas, a good spirit behind it that just didn't pan out. So it was part public service, like, okay, yes, we know standard baseball card prices are going up, packs are going up. It's hard for, you know, an 8 or 9 year old kid to afford these, but we're going to do our best to, you know, put out a product that they can afford and they can like. But of course, the deeper issue here was, how do you keep kids interested in baseball cards? Well, first you have to hook them. So they tried to produce a very kid-friendly card. And in 1992, a kid-friendly card involved really, really bright colors. It also involved, angling pictures just a little bit to the side so they were kind of diagonal, and lots of MTV language, or should I say Bart Simpson language. That's kind of the feel. This had to be 1991, 1992, MTV, Bart Simpson, Mountain Dew, radical, kind of lingo. And that's what they did. And we kind of made fun of that with one of the Action Shots cards in our video, where you flip the card over and you're reading the description of the Action Shots. And, it just says, awesome at the top. And it's kind of laughable now, when you're in your 40s and you're looking at these. But, I'd have to say, even as a teenager, they were kind of neat. And I would imagine for a kid who was a little younger, say 7, 8, 9 years old, if you were reading these cards, then it was right up your alley there. Now, Triple Play and Donruss had to, make this set appealing to kids, not just with the, very early 90s bright, colorful design to it, but also some of the content that was with it. So what you had to do was you had to reduce the size of the set. You couldn't have something that was 700 plus cards to it, because no kid who's 7 or 8 years old is going to go chasing after a 700 card set. So they reduced it to a 264 card set, which means Donruss Triple Play is loaded with stars, as well as some potential rookies, some who didn't quite do so well. My favorite, Eddie Zosky, who was the shortstop of the future for the Toronto Blue Jays, and of course he didn't pan out. But they did feature some younger stars, especially in the Gallery of Stars inserts. And the Gallery of Stars cards are what really separates the Triple Play set in how Gallery of Stars was approached. For years, Diamond Kings, you had basically the team MVP for each major league team had a Diamond King card in the Donruss set. Well, the Gallery of Stars, it was only 12 cards as opposed to 27 for Diamond Kings. And the first 6 cards were players who were traded or who had signed with free agents over the winter. So in many ways, the Gallery of Stars cards were kind of a mini, and I do mean mini because it was only 6 cards to start with, traded set or an update set. And in 1992, you had Bobby Bonilla, who of course legendarily signed with the New York Mets, Wally Joyner with the Kansas City Royals, Jack Morris with the Blue Jays, Steve Sachs with the Yankees, Danny Tartable with the Yankees as well, and Frank Viola with the Red Sox. Now, the other 6 Gallery of Stars cards, these were some of the bigger prospects. No, not Eddie Zosky. However, Jeff Bagwell, Ken Griffey Jr., David Justice, which we pulled from the pack, Frank Thomas, Ryan Klesko, another one of those big Atlanta Brave names, and not a rookie or a prospect, but certainly one of the most popular players in the major leagues at the time, Cal Ripken Jr., was the other member of the Gallery of Stars. So you've got these inserts with well-known names that had changed teams, or up-and-coming prospects, or a legend in Cal Ripken Jr., and you had some notable star players in the base set. Not only did you have star players, but you had notable ballparks. Remember, the ballpark revival started in 1992, thanks to Camden Yards in Baltimore. With that ballpark opening and everybody falling in love with those old retro-style ballparks, now you had pictures of Camden Yards, you had Wrigley Field at night, which in 1992 was still kind of a new thing. You had mascots as well. So we had the San Diego Chicken, and the Philly Fanatic had a card too. That was the first trading card for the Fanatic. Of course, the San Diego Chicken had a card in 1982, so his second card, I guess you could say. But you had mascots, you had pictures of star players when they were kids, and then you had kind of the fun side of things, whether it was Action Shots or you know, fans getting autographs before a game. A lot of the life of the game or lifestyle of the players was featured here. So you have a very eclectic mix of cards that come in this set. You got stars, you've got prospects, you've got some fairly well-known players in the game, but you also have action shots, kid shots, game day kind of activity shots, as well as the Gallery of Stars cards. Now, the first six Gallery of Stars cards were inserted randomly into the 15-card wax packs. The other six, or I should say the 12 overall, there was one each in the jumbo packs. So the jumbo packs became highly sought after as those were released a little later on in the pack release. So you had a very unique set here, not just in design and really bright colors and kind of a goofy layout that appealed to very young kids, but like I said, a very eclectic mix of what you had on the cards. And not only did you have an eclectic mix of what was on the card in terms of players or the action, but on the back of the card, a completely different approach by Donruss here, where when it came to stats, you had a two stat line report. You had 1991 stats and then career stats. And then at the bottom in this ginormous home plate, you had very large text and talking about either an accomplishment by the player or maybe a rule of baseball or some historical footnote. Action shots would describe the action that was in there. The kid shots, you know, before they were stars would have a little, you know, hey, so-and-so was a star for Pony League in his hometown or whatever. So you had a lot of dialogue. And it's interesting because think back to 1992, all of the other sets that were all going in the direction of premium style sets, less is more when it came to text. We didn't want to read. We just wanted pictures. We wanted border to border pictures on these cards, and not just on the front, but on the back. And Triple Play eschewed that, where you not only have the small pictures kind of at an angle on the front to make room for graphics and logos and stuff like that, but on the back you had no pictures. You just had some stat lines and a lot of storytelling here. So while Donruss Triple Play may have been doing some good in teaching youngsters how to read and educating them on the game of baseball, it went totally against the grain with what was trying to be accomplished elsewhere in the hobby, where you had more pictures. So Donruss Triple Play really did push the envelope in creating a card that was different from the norm. And that was a good thing in that you could show, all right, this is something that you're not going to see in the more pricier cards that adults have snapped up, but you're going to see some things too that should be appealing to kids, and that's bright colors, that's star players, and a small set. It's easy to collect this set. You think about it, you buy a box of Donruss Triple Play, you could probably get a complete set out of it as long as you didn't have too many dupes. And that, of course, would be the downside to the Triple Play cards, is that, you know, if you had a whole bunch of cards, you might have had some dupes along the way just because of, what, 15 cards per pack. I forget how many packs were in each box. I don't think it was 36, maybe 24, but you do the math. You're bound to get three or four of some cards for certain players. So how did this fare? Well, in 1992, did kids buy Donruss Triple Play? Yeah, I was certainly one of them. And there were many other kids who did as well. But the consumer was changing quite a bit to where even kids who were getting into the hobby were looking for cards that had higher face value. Hey, you might have been buying Donruss Triple Play cards, but you know what else you were buying? Beckett Baseball Monthly. You were buying those price guides as well. Because, sure, the Triple Play cards were nice and flashy and loaded with stars, but if you were going to get, say, a Barry Bonds card, you wanted the Barry Bonds Upper Deck card or the Barry Bonds Top Stadium Club card. Same thing with young stars like Frank Thomas or Ken Griffey Jr. You wanted to pull those cards that were worth $4, $5, $6 out of the pack, not some card that, you know, had lots of flashy colors and looked kind of neat or goofy, as the case may be. So the consumer was changing, not just the fact that adults were taking over the hobby and making lots of money off of it, but the kids who were buying as well were not necessarily buying cards just for the fun of it. Some were looking to get into it as a business and be savvy traders. And that is something that certainly did not help Don Russ's cause. Of course, being right in the middle of the junk wax era, Don Russ Triple Play was just one of, I don't know, like 20 brands that were out there at the time. And it wasn't just the usual Topps Fleer, Don Russ Score, Upper Deck Bowman. You know, you had Stadium Club, you had Fleer Ultra, you had Pinnacle, you had Leaf Studio. You had just this cannibalization going on by all of these card makers. And Don Russ was one of the guiltiest parties. You not only had the base set, but you also had Pinnacle, you had Triple Play, you had Leaf, you had Leaf Studio. There was just too much. You know, each flagship brand had five or six offshoots, and it was just too much to take. And unless there was something that was incredibly compelling to buy Triple Play other than it's new, then you didn't really want to buy it. And that was the case for a lot of collectors. First of all, because it was aimed at kids, while Don Russ was trying to create this new revenue stream and target the youngest of collectors, at the same time, you turned off anybody who was older. Now, again, I was a little over the intended target, not by much, but if you're, say, 17 or 18 years old, are you going to buy a product that is specifically designed for somebody who's 5 to 12 years old? Probably not. In fact, more than likely, you're not going to. So, yeah, they're trying to target this very niche group of collectors or potential collectors, but in the process, you're kind of shutting the door on 90% of the people who are collecting at the time. And then there are the factors that worked against Don Russ that they didn't really have much control over. And as I mentioned before, that was the dawning of the internet. Now, the Internet of Things, as we know it today, was still rolling out very slowly and quietly in 1992. But the information that you could get was starting to come faster. Everybody had ESPN in their household. You had SportsCenter. If you wanted to see Camden Yards in Baltimore or Wrigley Field at night or Sky Dome in Toronto, that was another one of the cards that was created in Triple Play that year. If you wanted to see any of those, you could see them on SportsCenter. You could see it on Sunday Night Baseball because all three of those locations are either legendary, such as Wrigley Field, revolutionary, such as Camden Yards, or, you know, the Blue Jays were a contending team then. So you were exposed to those stadiums all the time. You got to see action shots, not in these very tiny 3 or 4 picture frames on a standard size baseball card. You got to see it in the top 10 plays of the night or the plays of the week that you saw on SportsCenter, the big show with Keith and Dan on Sunday nights. So, you know, it was an aged product, amazingly. Even though Triple Play was a new idea with a lot of neat angles and trying to, you know, bring in a different younger audience, some of the things that made Donner's Triple Play different from other baseball cards also made it outdated. Not drastically outdated, just the train was pulling away from the station and Triple Play was still kind of standing on the platform wondering when it should get on. So you not only had the internet where you could look up a picture of Camden Yards, or you could look up a picture of Cal Ripken Jr. as a kid, but things like action shots and stuff like that, you know, we were gravitating less from still images and more to highlight packages in local sportscasts as well as ESPN Sports Center. And then, as I said, you know, as the internet started penetrating into homes in 1993, 94, 95, you know, what seemed to be really revolutionary by Don Russ Triple Play in 1992 was very quickly outdated. Now, as for the Triple Play product, it didn't even make it to 1995, specifically because the niche audience was too niche. And again, kids and their spending habits were changing in the hobby where, yeah, sure, some kids wanted cards that just looked good, but others were looking for the financial angle to it. So by 1993, when Triple Play was released, it had completely changed its look away went the bright colors and the loads of text on it and kind of the fun, goofy MTV Bart Simpson look to it, all of a sudden, 1993 Triple Play looks more like those inspirational posters, or better yet, with the big silver letters and the bigger pictures and the black borders. You know, everything was black and silver back in the early 90s, you know, thanks to the Raiders and, you know, the White Sox changing their colors, and everybody was, you know, going black and silver back then. You know, the 1993 Triple Play cards actually kind of looked like movie posters for Terminator 2. You know, all of a sudden there was this bold and cold look to Triple Play, which contrasts 180 degrees different from the fun red, orange, yellow Bart Simpson don't have a cow man look. All of a sudden it was Hasta La Vista, baby, in 1993. And Donruss did that because they wanted to basically abandon the niche market, and they just wanted to create a different baseball card that had a lot of the look and feel of the 1993 sets, the base sets that were going out. And by 1994, when Triple Play came out, again, it basically completely abandoned anything that was supposed to be fun, goofy, lighthearted, bright, and colorful that you saw in 1992. Again, kind of going for the poster look. Maybe not the Terminator 2 movie poster, but definitely a card size version of the posters you probably had in your bedroom when you were a kid. And if you think I'm kidding, just do a Google Images search for 1994 Triple Play baseball cards, and you'll see what I mean. If you didn't collect Triple Play back then, if you blew these up into poster size, they would absolutely look great, you know, on your bedroom wall, or, you know, in a sporting goods store or your local card shop. That's kind of the look and feel that Triple Play had in 1994. And by then, Triple Play was just getting completely lapped by all the other cards, not just the base sets and the premium sets, but the heavy inserts and the refractors and the parallels and everything else that was starting to emerge in the mid-1990s. Triple Play just couldn't keep up, and Donruss killed it off after the 1994 season. Now, when Donruss eventually died a horrible death, and the rights and the trademarks went to Panini, Panini decided to resurrect Triple Play back in 2013, and definitely went after the young kid angle once again. But instead of having bright colors and goofy picture angles and stuff like that, the 2013 Triple Play baseball cards were almost like comic book drawings of some of the top players in Major League Baseball at the time. So what Donruss got away from in the mid-1990s, Panini, in reviving the Triple Play brand, tried to go fully into in 2013. And it wasn't just comic book, you know, it was almost like you know, this very simple graphic art look to the cards. And at first you would think that that would work, but what didn't work was Panini didn't have the right to use official licenses from Major League Baseball. So they couldn't use team logos or even team names. In fact, if you look at these Panini cards for Triple Play in 2013, it doesn't say Yankees. It says New York, and, you know, the name of the team is in a pennant that is colored like the Yankees. Same thing, you know, Washington, Arizona, Toronto, you name it. So even though you had some of the biggest stars of the time, including Paul Goldschmidt, Albert Pujols, Bryce Harper, Kevin Youkilis, just to name a few, Derek Jeter, Mike Trout, you had these rather lampoonish cartoons that couldn't even display a team logo, and it just looks like a really bad art project. It's like that kid in ninth grade who made his own baseball cards. It's okay, you know, good try, good effort. That's basically what Triple Play was in 2013, and understandably, the set was not extremely popular. Now, with Panini Triple Play, sure, you can get some of these top cards, such as Derek Jeter or Mike Trout, and you can get them graded, and if they're in PSA 10 condition, then you can sell them for a ton of money. But you know, when it came to just collectors and an interest in, you know, kind of reviving this underappreciated brand from the early to mid 1990s, generally speaking, it just wasn't really welcomed, other than collectors trying to find that PSA 10 of some of these bigger names that they could exploit for some extra money. So Panini, Tribe, Triple Play flared out, it flared out despite having some unique things. Like I said, the cartoonish look to it. Also, they had interesting cards that came with it, including eye blacks and tattoos. So, you know, there are some unique things that came with it, but it was just this really bizarre effort to try to not only rehash a brand from the past, but try to revitalize it. And again, the best phrase I can come up for it is good try, good effort. It just didn't last more than a year, and Panini moved on to reviving other aspects of old Donruss cards for future sets. If you're collecting Triple Play, it's simply because you want to go back in time 30 years ago. Maybe there was something special about the set when you bought it then, and it brings back some special memories now when you look back at them. So if you're interested in a quick and easy set, like you'll even have a little space for a foam block and a 300 card box, then Donruss Triple Play is a good one. Buy a box, probably won't cost you more than $20 with shipping, and open them up, put together that set, see what Gallery of Stars cards you get in them, and have some fun looking back at a very innocent time, you know, pre-internet, inundation of highlights and ESPN Sports Center and of course, you know, challengers to ESPN over the years, Fox Sports and NBC Sports Network, everybody else who's tried to imitate Sports Center. You know, this was kind of the very end of a very different time. And I said before, it was a vacuum. Not just in the hobby, but just in society. There was a different way that we were entertained, a different way that we got our information. So this is like the last days of pre-internet, the last days of 400 channels on your television, the last day of sports highlights at your fingertips on mobile phones. You know, we're still looking at newspapers for this information. We're still opening up a physical encyclopedia to look up things. And, you know, again, with action shots or pictures of ballplayers when they were kids, you couldn't find that stuff as early. So there you go. It's a fun thing to look back at if you were a youngster in 1992. Perhaps it'll bring you back to those innocent days of, yep, it was fun before we had social media and the internet and all these highlight packages available at our fingertips. And that's what this set should be. Just a fun thing to kind of throw back, rip open a few packs, see what you get inside, and see how many sets, not just one, see how many sets you can get out of a wax box or, you know, maybe 10 or 12 jumbo packs, see what you can pull together from there. All right, time to get to the bottom of the order as we take a look at three cards pulled at random from this jumbo pack of 1992 Donruss Triple Play. And the cards that we have here are some pretty notable names from the time. Like I said, Triple Play was loaded with stars and also players that you would be familiar with, as well as some potential prospects. And the first player that we pulled here, and I don't believe we've talked about him, is Andy Van Slyke, who was one of the best defensive players of his time, pretty decent offensive player as well, involved in one of the bigger, more shocking trades in the mid-1980s, a couple of popular players going back and forth between teams. And Van Slyke, best remembered for his time in Pittsburgh, however, it was his time before that that has earned him a spot in the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame recently. Well, let's start from the very beginning, shall we? Andy Van Slyke, born in December of 1960 in Utica, New York, attended New Hartford Central High School in New Hartford, New York, where his father was the principal. That's a tough life to live. You know, you hear the stories about the preacher's daughter. daughter. Well, the principal's son is probably just as envious of a position to find yourself in. Well, he was a star with the high school baseball team. In fact, earned All-American honors as a senior at New Hartford Central High. Certainly caught the attention of the St. Louis Cardinals, made him a first-round pick, sixth overall in 1979. And he would work his way up through the Cardinals farm system, making his major league debut in June of 1983. Now, Van Slyke, even though many people remember him best as an outfielder, when he started, he was a jack of all trades. He could play not just the outfield, but all three outfield positions, but he was also quite suitable on the corners at first and third base as well. Now, because of his throwing arm, he would often play the angles in the outfield, typically right field with the St. Louis Cardinals the first couple of times. And Whitey Herzog was able to shuffle him all around the outfield along with Willie McGee as well as Tito Landrum. And he was part of this up-and-coming Cardinal team, the fastest show on turf. No, that was the St. Louis Rams, right? But certainly Whitey Ball in the mid-1980s lived up to the name of speed on the base path, solid defense as well, and some pretty consistent hitting. And Van Slyke certainly fit into that, which is why it was a shock that he was traded from the Cardinals to the Pirates in 1987. What was equally a shock was who was coming the other way. Now, this trade involved Van Slyke as well as catcher Mike LaValle for minor league pitcher Mike Dunn and catcher Tony Pena. Pena was very popular with the Pirates, so it was a shock that the trade happened in spring training of 1987. In fact, it happened on April Fool's Day. So with a trade like that, with some of the big names, of course, Van Slyke thinks that he's being fooled. No, it wasn't. But he would find himself ending up in a great situation in Pittsburgh, even though the Cardinals were going to go on to win a National League pennant in 1987. Van Slyke would find some fame and fortune with a rebuilding but very quick up-and-coming team in Pittsburgh. And he would be part of a, dare I say, legendary outfield in Pittsburgh as he played mostly center field alongside Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonilla. That's right, in between the Killer Bees was number 18, Andy Van Slyke. Now, Van Slyke started picking up All-Star honors with Pittsburgh. In fact, he was a three-time All-Star in the major leagues, all three of those appearances coming with the Pirates, 1988, 1992, and 93. And this is where his prowess for solid defense, of course, his great arm in center field, really caught the attention of baseball writers and fans as well, as he would win five Gold Gloves, in fact, five consecutive Gold Gloves from 1988 to 1992. He wasn't just limited to good defense, though. He was also a pretty solid hitter, a career batting average of .274, but a two-time Silver Slugger Award in 1988 and 1992. He had a very accurate throwing arm, not just powerful, but he could hit a spot. So much so that fans in Pittsburgh created a seating section called the Slyke Zone, kind of a playoff of Strike Zone there. But the Slyke Zone showed the love and affection Pirates fans had for Andy Van Slyke at the time. Now, Van Slyke got himself into some trouble while with Pittsburgh. You may recall during the Gulf War back in 1991, Major League Baseball said that players on their helmets had to wear on the back of their helmets a sticker that had the U.S. flag and the Canadian flag kind of crisscrossing each other to show unity and support, part of the unified battle against Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Well, Van Slyke decided to piss off the people of not just Canada, but in particular the province of Quebec. And of course, the French Canadians in Quebec, not always big fans of American military intervention, and especially when the rest of Canada is involved with that intervention. So Van Slyke decided to scratch off the maple leaf from his Canadian sticker and told the world why he was doing it, because in Montreal, Expos fans were booing the American team during the national anthem. So he's just like, well, yeah, I guess they won't care if I scratch this off. Faye Vincent, then the commissioner of Major League Baseball, had to step in and say everybody needs to have this sticker in whole on their helmet. Thank you very much. Now, Van Slyke would continue to play for the Pirates through the 1994 season, and he would move on very briefly to Baltimore and Philadelphia in 1995, wrapping up his career, a 13-year career, following the 1995 season. Now, he would follow along a couple of his former teammates, and in fact, a former manager from Pittsburgh, into the coaching realm. So prior to 2006, he was named the first base coach for the Detroit Tigers, of course managed by Jim Leland, who was the manager for the Pirates in the late 80s and early 90s. And then when Jim Leland left the Tigers in 2009, Lloyd McClendon, several years later, former teammate of Van Slyke, would become the manager of the Seattle Mariners. In 2014, Van Slyke became the first base coach for the Mariners, as well as a hitting coach and instructor in 2014 and 2015. Now, as I mentioned, he is part of the St. Louis Sports Hall of Fame, not the National Baseball Hall of Fame. In fact, he got zero votes, so he was knocked out after his first Hall of Fame appearance. But that doesn't mean that Andy Van Slyke has just kind of disappeared from the general public. In addition to some of his previous coaching stops, he has written a couple of books, including Tiger Confidential, The Untold Inside Story of the 2008 Season, and sports fiction called The Curse, Cubs Win, or Do They? Of course, the Cubs eventually would win in 2016, but in 2010, it was sports fiction to suggest that the Cubs could actually win a World Series. Now, the Van Slyke name has been heard elsewhere in sports. He has three boys. Actually, he has four boys, but three of them are involved in sports. Scott Van Slyke, part of the Dodgers organization for many years, also plays in Korea. A.J. Van Slyke played for the University of Kansas and was also in the Cardinals minor league season, or minor league system, for a few seasons. And then Jared Van Slyke was a defensive back for the University of Michigan football team. So there you go. Andy Van Slyke, a solid defensive contributor, but also not too shabby with the bat during his time with primarily with the Pittsburgh Pirates, but also with the St. Louis Cardinals, and very briefly Baltimore and Philadelphia before he hung him up. Now let's move on to another player who is best known for his glove. Even though he could be mistake prone, he was part of a pretty magical tandem, mostly for the Chicago Cubs. We're talking about Sean Dunstan. Yes, if you grew up watching the Cubs on WGN, like I pretty much did, spent much of my youth watching Harry Carey talk about Sean Dunstan, you'll be amazed that Dunstan was in the major leagues for, what, 18 seasons. I totally forgot that he played for so long, mostly with the Cubs. In fact, he was with the Cubs a couple of times. But he made it all the way through the 2002 World Series with the San Francisco Giants. But this great, lengthy Major League Baseball career started from very humble beginnings, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, not exactly in the best part of Brooklyn, growing up in the Linden Apartments. That was a public housing facility. His parents working a couple of jobs to take care of Sean Dunstan, as well as a younger sister, Kendra Johnson. And boy, they were breaking their backs to help him out here, but Sean Dunstan would find out very quickly that hard work and, I hate to say blue-collar effort, but that hard work and dedication shown by his parents was reflected well on him as well. Not just a hard worker, but also an excellent student, again, in a very bad neighborhood. He excelled in the classroom, but also on the field, playing for Thomas Jefferson High School in the Brooklyn area. He was primarily an infielder, and in his senior year, he batted 790. He also hit 10 home runs and stole 37 bases for a high school senior. pretty darn good. So you can understand why the Chicago Cubs not only made him a first-round selection, but he was selected first overall in the 1982 draft. Dunston signs a one-year contract with the Cubs for $100,000. That is probably sounding like $10 million to a kid growing up in a bad part of Brooklyn. And he goes into the Cubs farm system and at first does not perform extremely well. In fact, by many indications, Dunston is looking a little bit like a bust. However, he starts coming around in the 84 season, and going into spring training in 1985, the Cubs decide to make the shortstop position competitive. So it is Sean Dunston, the rookie, against the veteran Larry Boa. Now, coming out of spring training, Dunston would win the starting job, making his major league debut on April 9th, 1985, but he really comes out of the gate struggling. So much so, the Cubs actually send him back to AAA after several weeks. He finds his game once again and is able to come back up in August. Now, what also helped Dunston out was not only being able to find his game and find his confidence again in AAA, but also by this time, Larry Boa was playing out his last days in the big leagues, so the position was basically Dunston's to have for good. Now, eventually, he would team up with all-star second baseman Ryan Sandberg, and that would help Dunston become an all-star himself. In fact, two-time all-star, 1988 and 1990 in front of the home crowd at Wrigley Field. So Sandberg and Dunston really working together as a great duo, part of the 1989 NL East Division champion Chicago Cubs. In fact, winning over a lot of fans too at that time, as fans came up with the Dunston meter, keeping track of his batting average throughout the 1989 season and into the 1989 playoffs against the San Francisco Giants. It was actually the Shawnometer, not the Dunston meter. The Shawnometer was the big banner that you could see out in the Wrigley Field stands during this time here. And it seems like Sean Dunston is going to turn into that star that the Cubs really thought of, as his career is really starting to blossom here in the late 80s and heading into the 1990s. Now, it would appear that Dunston was going to become a big-dollar free agent in the winter of 1991. And why not? Because he had earned it, two-time All-Star, again, a great double play partner with Ryan Sandberg, and the Cubs aren't going anywhere in 1991. In fact, they're sliding backwards pretty quickly from their success in 1989. Well, instead of going out into the open market and perhaps making some huge dollars, he signs a four-year, $12 million contract to stay with the Cubs. Now, that's chump change these days, but back in 1991, that was pretty big, averaging $3 million a year. Not shabby from a $100,000 contract that was signed back in 1982 when he was drafted. However, things don't work out too well as Dunston gets injured early in spring training, required surgery to repair a herniated disc in May of 1992, and he only appeared in just a handful of games in the 1992 season. Now, the Cubs didn't protect Dunston from the 1993 expansion draft for the Rockies and Marlins, and that really hurt him. He had said publicly, well, I can't play for the Cubs anymore. Well, he was kind of damaged goods too. The Rockies and Marlins passed on him, and Dunston decided to go, all right, well, I'll come back. Although his time with the Cubs in 1993, very short-lived. Again, only playing a handful of games as he was having a lot of difficulty recovering from that back injury. Managed to have a much better comeback in 1994, and that certainly helped him as he was a free agent finally after the 1995 season, ending an 11-year run with the Chicago Cubs. And the Cubs wanted to have him at third base. He wanted to stay at shortstop. Cubs didn't sign him. He decides to move on, and he moves on to greener pastures with the San Francisco Giants in 1996, signing a one-year contract worth $1.5 million, so a small percentage of what he probably would have made in 1991, but the best option he had at the time. Struggles with the Giants in 1996, even though the Giants were very hopeful and positive that his experience and his all-star status from previous years would come back, didn't quite happen. So he would actually leave the Giants after the 96 season and go back to the Cubs in 1997. Cubs, once again, not in a position to really contend. So in August of 1997, he is traded to the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Pirates were contending at the time, and they were in desperate need of a shortstop after a couple of their regular shortstops were injured. So he had a brief stint of success in 1997. The Pirates did not make the playoffs or really do anything in the remaining few games of the season. So in 1998, he signs with the Cleveland Indians. Again, all-star history, good leader, pretty good defensive player as well, modestly successful with the bat. He was a .269 career hitter, but things aren't working out for the Indians as they trade Dunston along with Jose Mesa and Alvin Mormon to the Giants for Jacob Cruz and Steve Reed. So once again, tour number two with the San Francisco Giants for Dunston, and he did not do extremely well in the couple of months that he was with them. So he's back on the free agent market, signs with the St. Louis Cardinals to a one-year contract in 1999. While at the trade deadline in 99, the Cardinals dish him to the Mets for Craig Paquette. So he replaces Melvin Mora on the Mets roster, and the Mets come close to making a nice little run in 1999. They fall in the NLCS to the Atlanta Braves. Dunston once again is a free agent, goes back to the Cardinals for the 2000 season, and after a fairly uneventful 2000 season, goes on to the Giants one more time, tour three of three with the Giants in 2001 and 2002. As I mentioned, he did get to the World Series in 2002, his first World Series as a player, actually hit a home run in Game 6 off of Kevin Apier of the Angels. However, the Angels would go on to win that game and win the series. Now, after his career wound down, like I said, a .269 career average, also 1,814 games, and he actually had a pretty low on-base percentage because he didn't walk much. He was a guy who would put the bat on the ball and either hit safely or hit into and out in many cases here. Now, even though he was prone to making mistakes, like I said, he had a pretty solid run with the Cubs alongside Ryan Sandberg. And after he was done with his career, he would move to Fremont, California, work as a special assistant for the Giants, and that is a position that he's had for several years now and continues to hold to this day. There is another Sean Dunston, yes, Sean Dunston Jr., who has played professional ball as well. Last but not least, speaking of father and son duos, let's talk about Brian McCray. McCray would have been one of those promising young prospects that you found in the 1992 Donruss Triple Play set. And I remember there was a little bit of buzz to Brian McCray, and we'll get into the reasons why, not just because he was the son of Hal McCray, but Brian McCray has the rather interesting honor of being one of the few athletes who could probably bump Bo Jackson in his prime to a different position. And it's really more because of Bo Jackson and his injuries that were starting to crop up at this point in his career, and less with what Brian McCray could do. But McCray was just good enough offensively and defensively to make that happen. Now, he was born in Bradenton, Florida, and was a star player for Manatee High School and Blue Springs High School as well when the family moved to Missouri. He was a Missouri second team All-State selection in football and a first team selection in baseball. So, in many ways, following in the footsteps of his future teammate, Bo Jackson. Now, many people at first thought that McCray, while he was talented. Didn't really have first-round talent, but the Kansas City Royals, a team where his father, Hal McRae, played for many, many years, decided to take a risk on him, and they selected him in the first round, 17th overall in the 1985 draft, and offered him a six-figure signing bonus. So they really just threw all the chips at Brian McRae. When he saw that, he decided to turn down a football scholarship from the University of Kansas, and in fact didn't even play college sports at all, and went right into the minor leagues. Now, he struggled a little bit, very similar to Sean Dunstan, didn't really catch the world on fire, but was able to eventually work his way through his issues. But unlike Dunstan, it took McRae a lot longer for that to happen. In fact, he really didn't get his break until 1990. This is after he was, you know, hitting in the low 200s in Double A for many years. Bo Jackson gets injured, has a shoulder injury, and the Royals are finding very little success with veteran replacements in center field, namely Willie Wilson and Jim Eisenreich. So the Royals just turned to McRae because they're like, well, we got nothing else to lose here. Even though he's got nothing really going on at Double A, they bring him up, and he actually performs better at the major league level than he did at Double A, and it was hard to send him back down. So when Bo Jackson comes back from the disabled list, McRae stays in center field, and Bo Jackson moves to left field, and McRae would become a mainstay in the Royals center field, not just for the remainder of the 1990 season, but for the next four seasons. Now, interestingly, Hal McRae, Brian McRae's father, first off, they appeared in a spring training game in 1987. So they were the first father-son combination to appear in a major league game, if you include a spring training game. But this would also be the fourth time in Major League history that a father would manage his son on the team, as Hal McRae was named the team manager in 1991. So that, of course, certainly helps Brian McRae hang on to his job in center field. However, 1991 was a bit of a breakout season for him, as he was able to have some single-game highlights, also a 22-game hitting streak at that point in time, even though he was breaking out and finding some consistency at the plate and locking down center field. He also found some consistency striking out. In fact, struck out 105 times in the 1993 season. So he's starting to find his stride here in the early 1990s, is also starting to get paid well in 1994 and 1995. But in 1995, right before the season starts following the player strike, the Royals decide to move on from him. Of course, this is the dark days of the Royals, when they were basically moving any big contract, for anything that they could get pennies on the dollar. So they trade McRae to the Chicago Cubs. And it's a great story about this trade, because he was traded for Gino Morones and Derek Wallace. Morones and Wallace combined had 8 major league games. Yes, combined. Those two players played the major leagues for 8 games. This obviously lights a fire underneath McRae, and 1995, arguably his best season in his career, as he appears in 137 games for the Cubs, bats .288, 12 home runs, 48 RBI, still has a little trouble striking out, although he's able to get the strikeouts down to under 100 in the season. And when you look at his fielding stats as well, pretty good center fielder for Kansas City when he was with the Cubs. He was just as phenomenal in the outfield as well. So, that deal definitely worked out for the Chicago Cubs. I think it is pretty safe to say. He would have a pretty solid 1996 season with the Cubs, and a beginning to the 1997 season, but very much like Sean Dunstan, is moved at the trade deadline in 1997. The Cubs are going nowhere. They were paying him a lot of money, and his numbers were starting to drop a little bit. So he was traded in 1997, August of 1997, along with Mel Rojas and Turk Wendell, to the Mets for Lance Johnson, Mark Clark, and Manny Alexander. Now, after the 1997 season, McRae's numbers would continue to decline. 1998 hit a respectable 264, but certainly not what he was doing with the Cubs in previous seasons. In 1999, he's starting to play his way out of the lineup with the Mets, and while the Mets are making that run to the NLCS, they decide to trade McRae along with minor leaguer Tom Johnson and Rigo Beltran to the Rockies for Darrell Hamilton and Chuck McElroy. The Rockies then flip McRae to the Toronto Blue Jays less than 2 weeks later for the ubiquitous player to be named later. That would be minor leaguer Pat Lynch to complete the deal in 1999. And McRae's days with the Blue Jays, nothing really exciting to write home about. Of course, the Blue Jays were faltering at that time, too. In 31 games, he would have 101 plate appearances and hit a whopping 195. And that would complete his major league career. So the Kansas City Royals throwing all the money and, you know, spending a first-round pick on McRae. In the end, the Royals didn't get a whole lot out of him, but he did manage a 10-year big league career, 1,354 games, and 1,336 hits. Amazingly, and this kind of surprises me because McRae, like I said, was kind of one of those bubbling under prospects. Like, you knew he had some talent, but I think he kind of got lost playing in Kansas City. Certainly got overshadowed by other well-known players at the time. But he never appeared in an All-Star game. This is with a Royals team that didn't have a ton of All-Star talent at the time. And that kind of surprised me a little bit. I thought he may have had at least one All-Star appearance at the time, but didn't happen. Now, going into his studies at the University of Kansas, McRae studied broadcast journalism. He would also occasionally be an in-studio analyst for Cubs games on WGM. And when his playing days ended, he joined Major League Baseball Network broadcast on MLB.com, was also a contributor to Baseball Tonight on ESPN, and he eventually became a minority owner of a Kansas City radio station, the longtime home for the Royals, not now, but for many, many years, WHB 810 AM. Now, some bad news for McRae. He was arrested on assault charges back in 2019 after a Royals fantasy camp in Arizona. That's where the Royals spring train. And supposedly a woman that he was dating at the time accused him of dating another woman at the time, and there was a big, nasty, drawn-out brawl there. So Brian McRae with some bad press to his name, to say the very least. However, there have been some very positive things that he's done in his life as well. He has coached for the WCL League Victoria Harbor Cats, also coaches at NAIA Park University in Kansas City, and has been a big supporter of Big Brothers Big Sisters of America, as well as Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. And like I said, he's contributed a lot of time and money to those causes. But that arrest in 2019, definitely a black eye on his career. I'm trying to see if there was anything that came out of that case there. I don't see anything, so I'm not exactly sure what may have happened from that particular case. However, Brian McRae, by the way, I should mention, has also coached for the University of Missouri baseball team as well. So he is still involved in the game as a coach. I've seen the official title for him is student manager as well. So he is still very much involved in the game of baseball. And he was part of the 1992 Donruss Triple Play set that we took a look at. Again, if you're collecting it for money, boy, you're doing it all wrong. Yeah, you can get a few bucks out of a couple of the Gallery of Stars cards, but if you're going to go back and revisit Donruss Triple Play yourself, whether it's 1992 or the 93 or 94 or even the kind of goofy art project set of 2013 that Panini released, do it just for fun. You're not going to get a ton of money from these, likewise for many other junk wax sets, but do it because it brings back some good memories. Maybe it brings back some you know, memories of kid-themed stuff that you played with back in the early 90s, or maybe it was just one of those affordable sets that you were able to get your hands on back then. It is still very much affordable and very easy to collect, and it is, again, that harbinger of change in the mid-1990s as there was more ways to get your information and your entertainment and your education soon through the internet, but even through broadcast and cable television. Things were changing then, and 1992 was one of the last years for a lot of old technology and old ways of doing things. And Triple Play, even though it was different from other cards, unfortunately also dated from other card sets because they were hanging on to some of those old things from 1992. That by 1994 or 95 was completely old school and very quickly getting passed upon, not just by card collectors, but by society in general. All right, that'll do it for our look at 1992 Triple Play and the entire Triple Play sets from those years. I hope you enjoyed that, and thank you again for your feedback on the surveys, looking back at some of those 1980s and junk wax sets that deserved a second look. Now, as I said before, we'll do a similar thing. We'll put out a poll for baseball cards from the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s. We'll find some sets that you want to take a second look at. I'm also shopping on eBay. That's always a dangerous thing, right? Looking at a few interesting sets from junk wax era years that you may recall, some that I completely forgot about, but certainly willing to take another peek at. And again, no show 2 weeks from now. Normally we would have a show on Friday, July 2nd, but I will be in the middle of the big move to Arizona then, so we're going to bypass that week, enjoy the 4th of July holiday weekend, and listen to some of the archives. Listen back to some of the older shows when you get the chance. I think you will like those. If you don't already listen to those programs, they're free. They're available again via our home base at audioboom.com or on whatever platform you listen to, especially Apple Podcasts. They've got those available for you. We will be back 2 weeks after that, July 16th. Brand new show, brand new home studio for me, and perhaps it'll cool off to about 112. And yes, I can confirm it is very much a dry heat. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.